Hi, kids. Welcome to Bronco Land. We got some smart ones in the room.
It's the DenverBroncos.com podcast. Thanks for joining us once again. Ben and Mace with you. And today we have a very special guest to come later, our own Ben Garland. It'll be the Ben and Ben show a little bit later on, so stay tuned for that. First off, we'll talk here with Mace. The supplemental draft happened today, which was on Thursday, I should say. Thursday, supplemental draft. We also got the thrilling conclusion to the NFL Network's top 100 player rankings as done by the players themselves. So that sparked a little bit of conversation, especially socially, and that's been a series that they've been doing for the past few weeks or a month here. So I thought we'd talk a little bit about that. Start off here with the supplemental draft. What happened?
Okay, basically the way the supplemental draft works now, it's done by email. And, you know,
it's a little weird.
A little weird, but, you know, here's the thing. You're not going to have you don't want to get everyone in one place for something that's usually so insignificant, A. And B, a lot of the executives are on vacation. the Rams made the only pick and the first supplemental player selected in 3 years since Josh Gordon in 2012 when they took Clemson offensive tackle Isaiah Battle with the fifth round pick. And
that's
way
who you thought, wasn't it?
Yeah, I thought he would go. I thought of him more as a sixth or seventh rounder because there were some character red flags on him. And it's not like he was a three-year starter at Clemson. He kind of bounced around a little bit. I looked at him as too much of a project, even though I liked his quick feet and he has some athleticism, and I think he could add 10 or 15 pounds and get himself up to about 305, 310. So I thought the Rams maybe reached a little bit. He's not going to be ready for him to play this year for them. He's a project that they're gonna aim toward 2016 on Isaiah Battle. But there was enough interest in him that when he had his pro day on Tuesday, 25 teams showed up. So it was substantial, and you know, he's the first supplemental draft pick since Josh Gordon in 2012 to Cleveland. And it's funny that, you know, Josh Gordon's another guy whom we all know about his off-field issues as well. A lot of guys in the supplemental draft over the last couple of decades tended to be there for a reason. There was some, you know, they got kicked off a team or some other hardship or whether it was of their own doing or happening to them. So it's interesting. Now, the way the draft goes, though, each round is 9 minutes. A team emails the league and says whether they're going to pick a player in a round or pass. And if multiple teams say they're in one round, they're picking the same player, then the league has determined like the draft order for each round. Whoever has the highest priority, whoever comes first, basically gets the player. The Broncos passed in every round, as they have for now 26 consecutive supplemental drafts. The only time they ever selected a supplemental player was in 1989, Bobby Humphrey. And then they give their first-round pick the following year for the rights to get Humphrey. And even though his career didn't last long, he played, you know, 4 seasons in the league. The Broncos trade him after 3. He was never the same after he held out in 1991. It still wasn't a bad pick because he started off his career with 2,000-yard seasons, and the first of those helped the Broncos go to Super Bowl 24. So it wasn't a long career. And certainly what I think was a little bit of his own doing with the holdout in 1991 and never getting back on track. Gaston Green, I'm sure some fans remember, quickly usurped him and had a big year in 91, and Humphrey became an afterthought and was eventually dealt to Miami. But it wasn't a bad move by the Broncos, because I think, you know, without Bobby Humphrey, I don't know if they make the Super Bowl in 1989. So certainly if you can add a player like that, that helps you push you over the top for an AFC title, it was worth it. But, you know, that was back when the supplemental draft was a bigger deal than it is now. There hasn't been a first-round supplemental player since Dave Brown, quarterback, went to the New York Giants in 1992. So
seems like there's too much risk involved, I guess, that to give up another draft pick for the future.
Yeah. You got to really like the guy.
Yeah.
You've got to say, okay, this guy is better than anyone that I could get at that spot next year. And again, because you're generally dealing with guys that do have some red flags and some issues, that's going to give some teams some pause. And I think you know, obviously the Broncos you know, passed on the option of taking Battle, even though the offensive line is in a state of flux. And I think there were some pundits that thought the Broncos would be interested in Battle because he did fit a lot of the items that you're looking for in your template of a zone blocking offensive tackle. But you know, they've got Tyson Brailo. They brought back Michael Schofield. I think that certainly is another reminder that they're at least happy enough with what they have on hand to see where the current guys go and not supplement that with a player like Isaiah Battle.
Real quickly, you talk about players with red flags, and I'm working on a story that will probably be posted this coming week that I talked to Shane Ray, and obviously people thought he had red flags coming into the draft after his marijuana citation, which many have argued is pretty much overblown. Mm-hmm. And I would agree with. And
I would agree with that too. But at the same time, Shane Ray is not sitting here as a Denver Bronco if that doesn't happen.
Right.
Because without that, he's probably picked around 10, 12, 13. Probably would have been too much for the Broncos to move up to get him. But, you know, he had the citation. A lot of teams got scared. He became good value. You know, and then, you know, Randy Gregory had multiple marijuana issues. He dropped even further into the second round, and the Cowboys thought he was good value there. So, you know, it's kind of, for the Broncos at least, it was a blessing in disguise, even though, you know, Ray did lose some money falling through the first round a bit. I think it may well work out great for him because now he has a chance to develop behind Von Miller and DeMarcus Ware.
Well, I wanted to ask him about what he thinks about people who, you know, there are now millions of people or at least hundreds of thousands of people who pay attention to the NFL draft, and they make all these, you know, all these judgments on their own about who they think this guy is. And you know, sometimes that weighs a lot on people, but not for him. He seems to say, well, people are going to make their own minds up about people, and really that can't have any bearing on me.
Yeah.
He knows what kind of person he is.
He's got the right mindset, and certainly a lot of us had the chance to meet his mother the day after he was selected, and you talk to her and you understand that if the Broncos and this organization doesn't keep him on the straight and narrow, that his mother will.
Yeah.
You know, that I feel very confident in saying that I don't think that mistake is going to be repeated. I think he clearly was a bit humbled by that and learned a lesson from it. And you know, now he gets here and he's sitting there in the same position. It's the same position group with DeMarcus Ware. Is there a better example that you can follow not only in terms of performance but in terms of character and wisdom among pass rushers than DeMarcus Ware? It's almost too good to be true for the kid, I think.
Then one thing in that interview that really stood out to me with Shane, and that's going to be probably a focus of the story, is that he's buying his first house. He's buying a house at 22, and he grew up in a neighborhood that has gotten the nickname, unfortunately, the Murder Factory, because the zip code has the highest number of, or a very high number of, like, convicted murderers in prison or something like that. So I said, I asked him, when you come from a neighborhood like that, and do you think that you'd ever own your own home? And when you look back at roots of inequality, and you look back at one of the foundational problems with that, and that was housing discrimination, to so contrast that with buying your own home at 22, I think is just incredible.
It's wonderful for him. I mean, you wish that more young people like him had the opportunity that maybe their gifts aren't in football. Maybe their gifts are in academics or something like that. And you know, he's lucky enough to be to be in a profession where he's in lead at what he does. And that's the thing. Remember, just getting in the NFL means you're elite. Let's not lose sight of that. And the other thing, you know, these guys also have to learn to manage their money. You know, a house in this market is a pretty sound investment, I would say, as
in
well.
Denver?
Yeah, in the Denver area. you know, if you don't live around here, you may not be aware of it, but the real estate market is exploding here. And if you own a house that's well maintained, it seems like you're sitting on a potential gold mine.
Yeah,
that Denver's starting to go the way of places like Seattle and San Francisco and Portland and San Diego.
I would definitely say, especially Oakland and San Francisco, because the rentals are especially booming.
Yeah,
the rental industry. This is weird to shift to housing discussions here, but yes, the residential and housing kind of development has really exploded in the past few years.
Mm-hmm. It's insane. Just in the years I've been here, and the first time I moved to Denver was in 2002. And just seeing how it's grown since then. And that's why if you're Shane Ray, you want to manage your money well, and you don't want to overspend. But at the same time, if you're going to make an investment, the housing market in Denver seems a pretty good place to do that right now. And certainly the other thing with how, and you know, we can, you know, talk about the benefits of home ownership. You know, it provides some stability to him, you know.
A place for him
and his family to, you know, kind of put down some roots and get out of a pretty tough environment.
I asked him, are you going to join the homeowners association? He's like, yeah, I need a little pin for my jacket.
Yeah, just put it, you know, go get his Mizzou letter jacket. Get the homeowner association pin and put it on his letter. I mean,
yeah, he was a great guy to talk to about all that. I'm going to try my hand at a little segue here, and you talk about him being kind of mentored by DeMarcus Ware and Von Miller. Those are two guys who showed up in NFL Network's Top 100.
As they should.
Boom.
Yes.
Great segue.
Nicely done.
So we had 95. Emmanuel Sanders came in there. DeMarcus at 87, then a jump to Von Miller at 33, Demaryius at 20, and obviously Peyton Manning at number 5. Mm-hmm. I think the clear kind of missing guy there was Chris Harris, but maybe that's just because of we stay in tune with like the analytics and Pro Football Focus.
Yeah, Pro Football Focus did its top 101.
A little bit different. A
lot different. Peyton Manning wasn't in the top 101, but Chris Harris Jr. was number 4. And in that list, the Broncos had 7 of the top 60, including mm-hmm. Brandon Marshall, CJ Anderson as well, and Malik Jackson, who wasn't even a starter most of last year. So it's interesting to see the contrast between those two lists. Another thing that bothers me about the NFL's top 100, and it did even get close to even over 100, but 90% of the top 10 are offensive players. Mm-hmm. 75% of the top 20, offensive players. I'm sorry, but you know, I watch a lot of football. There's no way that 90% of the 10 best players in this league are on one side of the line of scrimmage. I'm sorry. That's even now. Granted, J.J. Watt was rated number 1.
Mm-hmm.
I think they got that one right. He should have been the MVP last year, but that's a discussion for another day. But you're telling Richard Sherman was 11th. I would have had Sherman in the top 5.
The only
Chris Harris Jr. Even though you know. I mean, you can argue for the PFF analytics they have number 4. I'm not even saying have him number 4, but how Chris Harris Jr. wasn't even in the top 20 or 25 based on the play that I've seen from him the last few years, it's crazy.
The only problem with arguing these rankings is that they're done by the players themselves.
Which shows me that the players are subject to the same biases as fans are in their voting.
Everyone's subject to the same biases.
I mean, that fans kind of...
Biases?
I wish it was an I on the end. There's not enough plurals with an I. The dot I would be if you had an like radius radii.
Okay.
Bias because a it's actually
biases,
it's bias. I think it's biases, not biases. I don't know.
Don't worry. I won't let.
I know how to spell it. I'm a writer. I mean, you know. I don't talk as much as I write for a living. But that's what I found interesting because you'd think the players would be able to see through the inherent overhyping of offense, but in the aggregate on the vote, they didn't.
Yeah.
Honestly, that's kind of that's disappointing to me. I thought they would have a better, you know, have a bit better read on that. That, but maybe part of it is, I'm just theorizing.
Well, I don't think many middle linebackers made it, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah,
like Kikwe was 14, but I can't remember.
Well, and even like Pro Bowl, which is, you know, 1/3 fans, 1/3 players, 1/3 coaches. When you see the Pro Bowl linebackers, there's a bias toward toward 3-4 outside linebackers.
Mm-hmm. Flashy.
Yeah, they're flashy. They get the sack total, and a guy who just racks up tackles but doesn't get, you know, and is all over the field but doesn't get a lot of sacks, Brandon Marshall last year, gets short shrift on that.
They did get Chris Harris in the Pro Bowl at least.
Yes. So
that was good on their part.
Well, so it's different. Like, well, cornerbacks don't – you're not thinking about, like, you don't have that one signature number unless you're talking about interceptions.
Yeah.
But this isn't 1990 where – year in and year out, you could count on a play on at least one player or two players getting 7, 8, 9 interceptions around the league. As passing has grown more accurate and based on rhythm and timing, you know, the interceptions have gone down. Now, if a guy has four interceptions, he's really having a great year in that category. So there's less focus on that, more focus just on who's the best in coverage. So I think that certainly helps a guy like Chris Harris Jr.
Yeah, well. And our last segment here before we get to Ben Garland has a tie-in to Ben Garland. At the time we're recording this, I've already spoken with him and recorded that part.
What? And it's not actually right after this?
This actually isn't even live.
Wow.
This is not like the
I'm
Mr. Show live taped call-in show or something like that.
It is, in the words of Hey Now, Hank Kingsley, live on tape. Not really tape, but you get the idea.
So I asked him what his first job is, and you'll have to stay tuned to hear what that is. It is a lot more interesting than mine, which was I worked at a Mexican restaurant, but I did have the pleasure of serving, Ric Flair and Jay Billis on a couple occasions.
Which Mexican restaurant was that again?
This was Moe's.
Oh, of course.
Yes.
Moe's. Hi, welcome to Moe's.
Exactly.
If you're from the South, you know all about that.
I think they're out of Atlanta.
Yes. I've been to the original Moe's. Didn't taste all that different from the Dilworth Moe's in,
that's
in
one
Charlotte
I worked
that I frequented.
We might have ran into each other.
I probably did run into you, and never. And hey, you know, 7 years later, you know.
Oh, for sure. I definitely would have been there 7 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, that's funny.
Were you ever working there like 9 o'clock in the evening?
Probably.
Because usually when I went there, it was on my way home from Bank of America Stadium going back to my palatial South Park apartment.
On my first day there, I went outside to take out the trash or something, and there was a small child dropping trowel going to the bathroom out there on the patio.
Oh, lovely.
And the mother was racing over, and I just kept on walking. I was like, this is my first day. I can't deal with this.
Yeah, my first job, gosh, it was pretty boring, actually. I mean, because it's nothing that far afield from what I'm doing now. The first paying job I had was stringing high school games for the St. Petersburg Times.
Oh, there you go. How old were you?
I was 17.
17.
It was $30 a story. Went up a little bit later, and then...
Shoot, that's a cool thing.
Yeah.
That's a cool deal, $30 a story.
First game I did was my school, St. Petersburg High School. I believe it was against Boca Ciega. St. Pete won 9-0. The funny thing is, I was sitting up in what passed for a press box at Stewart Field at old St. Pete High, and all my friends were looking up at me like, and it just was kind of weird, you know, because I was used to, you know, being...
They have a press box?
They have a very small press box, okay. Yes. But it's like coaches and...
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose I could have gone around and walked down the field, but I chose not to. I just did that game, but it was kind of strange, but it was fun. And, you know, 22 years later, still writing about football.
Hey, you know.
But it's a little different in the NFL than high school. But when I think of, when I think about it, like, boy, I'm basically doing the same thing I was when I was 17, you know. Ugh.
Was there a person that you covered that went on to the NFL?
I didn't cover any of his games directly, but I did allude to him once, and because he was playing high school football at the next school over, and that was Sean King, former Buccaneers and later Cardinals quarterback, led the Bucs to the 1999 NFC Championship as a rookie after going to Tulane.
Hero.
Yeah, Sean King, one of in my years breaking down the draft, one of my big misses. I thought he was going to be a long-term superstar. And frankly, after he became a starter as a rookie and then he got the Bucks to the NFC Championship, I'm like, holy smokes, I was I'm right. You know, there were limitations to his game. Although he was one of the better improv quarterbacks I'd ever seen. If it may be on YouTube floating around somewhere. Look up the play with him and Warwick Dunn in the 2000 game against the Rams when Warwick Dunn's about to be tackled and he gets it to Sean King, or maybe it was vice versa, and takes off up the right sideline on what would be the game winning drive on a Monday Night Football game. You can probably, because it was a Monday Night game in 2000, you can probably hear Dennis Miller with some, you know, some barely verbal reaction, like, ooh! Something like that, you know, before he veered into political comedy when he was doing football.
I didn't ever cover high school football, but I went to a few games that weren't just involved in my high school. And at the time, Independence High School in Charlotte was probably one of the top teams in the country. They were on the longest winning streak of any high school team.
Oh, by the way, Warwick Dunn lateraled it to Sean King.
Ah.
So, yeah, that was right. My initial thought was correct.
So, Hakeem Nicks was on that Independence team with, I think, Joe Cox. Hakeem Nicks and Muhammad Massaqua were both on that team, I think, which is crazy.
So they could pass the football a little bit.
Oh, my God. Yeah, they were really good.
Who was the quarterback? A great trivia question would be who's the quarterback of that team?
Joe Cox.
Oh, Joe Cox. Okay.
He eventually went on with Muhammad to Georgia.
Okay.
They both played at Georgia together. I think Joe Cox kind of unexpectedly made it, or unexpectedly jumped to the starter in one of his years at Georgia, and I don't think he really made it, but he was definitely very good. That was also the high school where Chris Leak came out of. Obviously, he fizzled out in the pros, but won a championship with Florida.
And his brother, CJ Leak.
CJ Leak, I don't think I've ever, I don't remember.
CJ Leak, I think, was the guy that had a scholarship offered to him by Wake Forest when he was a freshman.
Oh, my goodness. I do have a guy I went to middle school with. I think we talked about him, Walt Aiken. He's now with the Dolphins, so I watched him a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I never really went pretty far. Like, I never went to, like, state championship to go see, like, the elite guys. So I never saw some of the guys who are eventually here but just played in other areas. Our team was never all that great, unfortunately. We had one year where we almost went to state. Our quarterback was a running and passing threat, and he eventually went to Maryland.
Oh, by the way, it was Chris Leak that got the scholarship offer at 14.
At 14,
not CJ.
Well, he made it.
By the time he got offered a scholarship when Jim Caldwell was the coach at Wake Forest, and by the time Chris Leak came out of high school and then went to Florida, Caldwell was already. Caldwell had already not only moved on to Tampa Bay, but he by then had already moved on another step to Indianapolis on their staff. So he was two jobs removed.
Well,
anyway,
I think that'll wrap it up for our segment here. We'll get to the part that people are probably anticipating with Ben Garland's interview. So
yes, you've waited long enough.
Thanks for hopping on this week, and after this break, we'll be back with Ben Garland. Ben Garland, a special guest on the podcast today. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, of course. It's the Ben and Ben show today. I kind of want to start off, we'll get to football eventually, but you're very unique in your military background as far as being someone who does was it the reserve stuff?
Like National Guard.
National Guard. At the same kind of time as being a professional football player. That's something I could never do. And this is something that's been in your family for a long time. How far does this go back, being involved in the military and Air Force?
There's been a Garland in the Air Force ever since it broke off from the Army when it was part of the, you know, Air Force Signal Corps and the Army Signal Corps. Like, once we broke off from the Army, so we've always been the Garland in there, and a lot of colonels out there.
How proud does that make you to have that history in your family?
Oh, you gotta love the heritage. I mean, that's a big part of why I joined, and it's a big part of why I had that heart for service, and I absolutely love it.
You definitely have a huge heart for service. You're at every community event I think I've ever been to. You're always giving back, and that's got to help being from Colorado, right?
Absolutely. And that's a big part of why I do it. I mean, absolutely. So I'm so proud of being from Colorado, and I love this state. And anytime I can give back and help out the community, I'm going to.
Into your specific past, did you have a job growing up, like in high school?
I did. I did demolition in high school.
Demolition. What did that involve?
It was cool. I actually got to demo my old high school. So
that's every kid's dream,
oh,
is it
absolutely.
Not?
Absolutely. You know, going to those classrooms that teacher you hate and just smashing walls with sledgehammers. Had a lot of fun.
So you were involved in actually going inside and like maybe taking out drywall or something? Like
with yeah, the they were doing a remodeling type thing. So we had to like completely break through some brick walls and take down some buildings. And
Were you operating like the wrecking ball?
Oh yeah, we got we did sledgehammers, jackhammers. Got to operate the bobcats, push over some walls. It was a lot of fun.
How old were you when you were doing this?
Like 17, 16.
17. That's so you were literally in your high school.
Yeah.
Taking it down while you were going to school.
Right, during the summers and stuff. Yeah.
That's really cool. What did you do with the extra money? Did you save it? Or
it was for football camps.
For football camps.
I saved enough money to go to football camps so I could get a little better.
And then at that point, you were still on the defensive side. Well, you might have played both in high school.
I played both in high school, yep.
What was your offensive position in high school?
Line? I played anything from center to tackle.
Okay. Yep. So you moved around a lot.
Yep.
Did you have your own car in high school?
I did.
What was it?
I think it was a Dodge Stratus, a 98 Dodge Stratus.
What color?
Green.
Green. Was it like a bright green?
It was a little dull green. But I remember there's a Saturday Night Live where Will Ferrell, you know, was sitting around with the family. He goes, "You will respect me. I drive a 98 Dodge Stratus."
That was you.
That was me. So I like that skit.
I'm still on my high school car.
There we go.
It's been in my family ever since it came off the lot. It's at 80. The year, I guess, the model is 88,
yeah.
So 1987, a Volvo station wagon.
That's awesome.
It's going through my father, my older brother, and now me, I think it's on its last legs.
As old as you.
It is older than me, yes, by a few years, it's older than me. So I guess going back into your history, your family has this big history of being involved in service, and you've been involved in, you know, kind of not being this pampered young prodigy, I guess, right? You had your own demolition job working in kind of construction business. How does that kind of contribute to the drive that you have? You know, everyone talks about how hardworking you are, and that's clearly been helping as you move into up the ranks here in the offensive line.
That's been instilled in me since I was a little kid. You know, just work hard and work as hard as you can at everything you do and just make sure you're doing the job right. I mean, if that's your job and you're being paid for it, do it to your best of your ability and, you know, go home.
As far as the football side, what's the cohesion like on the line so far? That's been like a key point for Coach Kubiak, is that you kind of want to have that group together so they can build that chemistry.
And it's good. I think, and we're bonding well. And I think we got even a lot of guys right now in the off season right now training together, which I haven't seen really in years past. There's a lot more offensive lineman guys down here getting together and trying to build that cohesiveness and that chemistry. And we're doing little events. We're doing going golfing with each other and just kind of building that bond.
You're golfing now. Is that right?
We did a little trip like right after OTAs ended. It was Luis Vasquez and a few other offensive linemen, me and Gino, going out there and just, you know, getting to know each other, getting that team bonding up.
I saw you whitewater rafting.
Oh, yeah. We went that.
Class four, huh?
Class four. It was fun. I've done class five, and I prefer that, but it was a lot of fun. It was so much fun. We went with Cody rafting and went up there and just had a blast up in Clear Creek.
Now, this point is like kind of voluntary. You know, a lot of guys are either training on their own or off, you know, seeing the world. And yeah, I've seen you here, and I've seen Gino, and I've seen Ryan Harris, and I've seen
Lewis
here.
Yeah, Lewis here.
So pretty much the whole offensive line is pretty much just working out here.
Ty's out here working. I worked out with Shelly Smith over with Lauren Landau a little while ago. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we've got a whole bunch of the guys out here working.
What's been the surest sign of the progress y'all have made over like OTAs and minicamp?
I think you can definitely see it from the first day to the last. It was just a night and day difference. And I think we're going to continue to improve and work hard every day to be one of the best offensive lines in the league.
Now, how much are you going to know that first day you get the pads on at training camp?
Oh, I mean, the first day is always a little bit trying to get back into things. But at the same time, it's that first day in pads. So you got that. You were hyped up. Everyone's ready to go, trying to prove a point, show coach what you got, and really go after and show off what you have.
You also have a unique background in transitioning from defensive line, which you were still practicing like in your first year here, and then you moved over to the offensive line. How much experience did you have with the offensive line maybe in college, or did you kind of drop offensive line in after high school was finished?
Right. So after high school, I didn't even consider offensive line. I went straight to D-line and played that in college, and then when I got here, my first few years here, I was all D-line. So
who brought up maybe making that switch?
I think the idea was actually Luke Richardson. I think it was his idea, but they're kind of walking through the hallways. Magazoo was our old offensive line coach. Came up to me. He's like, hey, grab your playbook. And I thought he was joking at first. And he's like, seriously, make sure you get it by two. And so that was kind of how I was informed of the switch.
Now, was it like, did you just make the switch completely? Like you went from defense to offense just in real quick, or did you have to know like two playbooks?
Well, initially it was just a complete transition. Hey, you're going to offense. And then about halfway through the preseason, they brought me in and said, hey, you're going back to defense. I said, all right, cool. So I did that. I played a few games in preseason. I played the last game in preseason as a D-line. Then midseason, I was playing back in offense. And I was playing a little bit of both. And at the end of the year, they said, make sure to know both. So by the time we were at the Super Bowl, I was in going to both meetings and trying to know everything.
It's kind of difficult. That's a lot to know.
Oh, yeah.
Does that kind of help, though, knowing like what someone's going to do from the other side?
It does. It helps the perspective a lot, the idea and kind of knowing what they're going to do. And that's what a lot of offensive linemen try to figure out anyways. But being from that side and kind of understanding from their perspective has helped me a lot. But at the same time, the body position and the movement, all that stuff is nothing alike.
That was the point I was kind of about to talk about is that given the mobility of this zone blocking scheme and the mobility you would need as a defensive lineman, I was kind of wondering if those play well together, being able to be a little bit more agile.
Absolutely. I think being more, especially laterally explosive and something like that, being able to get the backside cutoffs, I think is very important to be explosive laterally, which a lot of D linemen are generally better at.
Now, one last question for you is, as you move into this season, it's a very different experience for you because, you know, you're working a lot with the first team. Has your preparation changed as you come into this year, this training camp?
Same mentality. It's just every single day I'm going to work as hard as I can to get better. And I'm going to try to improve one thing each day, and hopefully that'll pile up on each other and become better and better each day. So my mindset hasn't changed, but my opportunity has, which I'm really blessed and I'm glad I have.
Excellent. Well, thanks for coming on the podcast today. And I guess I'll be seeing you around here at the facility, but soon enough, be at training camp and be back to business.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Well, we are so excited to have you on, and I want to thank everyone for listening. You can subscribe on iTunes or just keep coming back. Thanks for joining us, and we'll catch y'all next week.